It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at a new plan from Governor Evers that would deal with the rise in youth vaping in Wisconsin, and we'll talk about federal efforts to ban certain flavored e-cigarettes. First, Dr. Martin Luther King's confrontations with overt racism in the Deep South are a big part of the story we tell today. But our next guest says there's a lot more to the story. King also fought against racial inequality here in the Midwest and elsewhere, and he was critical of the white northern moderates and liberals who backed his efforts in the South, but not in their hometowns. Jean Theo Harris reminds us of this history in a recent piece for The Washington Post. She's a distinguished professor of political science at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. She's also author of the book A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History. Jean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Dr. King, you say, talked about polite racism from white liberals during the civil rights movement. Can you talk about what he meant by that?
So one of the things, if we look at Dr. King, and this is really across his, again, shortened adult life, but really from the beginning of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference founding, which was in 1957, we hear Dr. King both calling and working against the kind of racial inequality of the South, but at the same time also talking to and being critical of and challenging to Northern liberals. So from 57 on, he's saying we need a liberalism that's liberal, not just in calling out sort of lynching in Mississippi, but that is equally outraged when someone can't get a job or can't get housing, you know, in their own cities, right? So he was calling out one of the things he's calling out is the tendency to see the problems elsewhere and not to attend to the problems at home, be it in New York or Milwaukee or LA. And also in this period, he is, even though they're building this movement in the South, he's also crisscrossing the North, joining with struggles across the Northeast and Midwest and West Coast, again, from Detroit to Boston to LA in this period. And I think we know much less about that.
Yeah, I came across a Martin Luther King quote after he was assaulted in Chicago in 1966. He was in the midst of housing discrimination protests there. He said, "I've been in many demonstrations all across the South, but I can say that I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hostile and as hate-filled as I'm seeing in Chicago." So just one example in the Midwest there. Why are we kind of, I don't know, blinded to that part of the story outside of the Deep South these days?
So I think part of the ways that we now tell the story of the civil rights movement, and I often talk about this as a kind of fable of the civil rights movement, is I think by telling a story that's in the South, right, that focuses on a Southern struggle from sort of 1954 onward, that is kind of driven by people like Dr. King, galvanized after Rosa Parks' bus stand, and a growing movement across the South that wins the support of Northern white liberals and journalists and ultimately the federal government. And then we have the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And I think that story is powerful, but it's limited, and I think it's easy because it's a story then that makes it seem like there's struggle, but then there's a largely happy ending. I think when you begin to include Chicago or Milwaukee or Boston or New York, where I live, you have to tell a harder story because you have movements in all of those cities, right, from the 50s and the 60s, calling out school segregation, calling out housing segregation, calling out police brutality, calling out job discrimination. And by and large, a lot of those movements are ignored, they're disparaged, and many of those problems, right, are with us today because we didn't take those movements seriously, and we didn't sort of really hunker down to do what we needed to do in terms of really addressing, again, school inequality, housing segregation, inequitable city services, policing, unequal policing. And so these are issues that people are calling out not just in Birmingham, right? But again, I think it's easier to kind of see the problem in Birmingham because then in some sense it's a problem and then we've solved it, right? And so I think part of the way we often now honor the civil rights movement, honor Dr. King, honor Rosa Parks is in part by putting the movement in the past. And to really grapple with the northern struggle, I think, forces us just to really also see what needs to be done in the present.
Talking to Jean Theo Harris from Brooklyn College of the City University of New York, she's talking about some unlearned lessons from the civil rights movement are often unlearned even to this day. Mm-hmm. Jean, let's talk about the response that King and other civil rights leaders got when they protested in places like New York or Chicago or Milwaukee from the white liberals and moderates who might have considered themselves otherwise allies of the movement.
Right, right. So as you mentioned, with the campaign in 1966 in Chicago, King gets a lot of backlash, not just that violent backlash that you just quoted him from, but also from white liberals, white allies, who said these direct action tactics, they were holding marches, right? They were doing open housing marches. You know, in some ways, a lot like what Father Grappi and people did in Milwaukee in this period as well, right? And this is, for many white liberals in Chicago, this kind of disruptive direct action made them uncomfortable. And so even though when it had been happening in Birmingham, many of those people might have been supportive, when it comes home, you're not doing it right. So I think that's part of the reaction. Another part of the reaction is this sort of talking about the ways to solve kind of inequality in northern cities, focusing on black behavior, black crime. And we see King also taking those kinds of language and those kinds of ways of framing the problem to task. So King will say, and I'm paraphrasing him, but basically when we ask sort of black people to follow the law, we also have to ask white people to follow the law. We have to ask them to sort of abide by sort of equal employment hiring, by kind of landlords to abide by kind of laws governing, right, tenements, welfare laws, police to abide, you know. And so he's saying we have to look at the kind of larger structures of inequity in these cities. And yet many times white liberals in those cities were saying, well, the solutions are going to be in changing sort of black behavior, changing the black community. And Dr. King is saying, no, we have to look at changing policy.
And you mentioned a direct action and sometimes disruptive protests. You've also talked more recently about modern day critics of things like the Black Lives Matter movement saying, well, you're doing things that Dr. King never would have done.
Right. And and I think there's a historian in me that's just like, if you may remember, you know, we've had a lot of people, you know, telling Black Lives Matter activists, be more like Martin Luther King. And in my head, I think to myself, be careful what you wish for. And really, I think people really miss the similarities in terms of the tactics, in terms of the larger kind of structural critiques that people like Dr. King is making, that people like Rosa Parks are making, to what kind of Black Lives Matter activists are making today, including that disruption and direct action were necessary, right? That part of kind of how injustice maintains itself is by the kind of comfortableness that many people have with it. And so part of why, and again, if we think of the kind of perhaps one of the most iconic moments of the civil rights movement being the Montgomery bus boycott, what is that, right? It is a disruptive consumer boycott. It is meant to bring the bus company and the city to its knees, right? But again, I think now when we look back on the Montgomery bus boycott, we've sanitized it. We've missed what the power of it was, right? But we've also missed how uncomfortable, right, it was, because it was sort of disrupting business as usual, right? So I think part of what King is saying kind of over and again is when he's criticized for these tactics, he's saying we are bringing this kind of tension, this inequality to the surface. It is there. We are not causing this, right? We are, you know, we are bringing this to the surface so it can be dealt with, right? But I think for many people, that kind of direct action or disruption is uncomfortable precisely because it brings that injustice sort of to the surface.
We're talking to professor and author Jean Theo Harris about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and how popular histories can fail to include his criticism of so-called polite racism by white liberals and his activities in the Northeast and Midwest as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you aware of this part of King's history? Are you just hearing about it for the first time? Did you already know this? Do you have questions for our guest about our civil rights history and the myth and reality? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Professor Jean Theo Harris from Brooklyn College at the City University of New York, talking about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., his critiques back during the civil rights movement of white moderates and liberals, especially in the North, who supported his civil rights efforts in the South, but not in their own hometowns. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts, and maybe your memories of that time. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Paul is with us in Madison. Paul, hi.
This is Marcus.
I'm sorry, Marcus in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Professor Harris. I'd like you to enlarge on this point. There is a lot of mythology about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. while he was alive. He was fiercely opposed by the Kennedy administration and the Kennedy liberals generally. They tried to hamstring him in every possible way they could, until the civil rights movement became a large enough factor that they sort of had to go along. But later on, when Dr. King started to point out his criticisms of the Vietnam War, militarism in general, capitalism, and was planning the Poor People's Campaign, he was actively opposed by the Democrats and the liberal left. I was wondering if you could speak on that, please.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Jean?
Thanks for the question. Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that Dr. King and that the civil rights movement, even as we sort of how we imagine it today, we imagine that most decent, good people supported the civil rights movement when it was happening, supported Dr. King. But that's not true. When you look at Gallup surveys from the early 60s, for instance, a majority of Americans are critical of the tactics. In the week before the March on Washington, a majority of Americans, again, surveyed by Gallup, have an unfavorable, are not supportive of the March on Washington. Like you mentioned, right, the Kennedy administration tries to prevent the March on Washington when they can't. They're still very wary of it. And in fact, it is after the March on Washington that the FBI's surveillance of King expands and Robert Kennedy signs off on the kind of, wall-to-wall surveillance of Dr. King that fall. So it is after the March on Washington that we see that surveillance expanded. Again, I think we often... on this day, we often are just treated to like endless replays of the end of the March on Washington speech. And I would ask people to go and look at the whole speech, because in fact, where King begins the March on Washington speech is about how America has given black people a bad check. And they have come to Washington because they know that the bank is not empty, right? But they have come to collect, right? This is a very different King than the kind of constantly dreaming King that we are often kind of bombarded with. As you mentioned, increasingly over the later 60s, we see King talking about the giant triplets of poverty, racism, and militarism, right? He comes out against the war in Vietnam. He is building a Poor People's Campaign, a multiracial Poor People's Campaign at the end of his life, which Coretta Scott King and and poor people across the country continue even after his assassination. So I think we backdate our admiration for him in some ways because, again, I think it is comfortable to think that, you know, good people sort of are on the right side of history. And I think one of the things that really looking at Dr. King's life and really looking at the civil rights movement reminds us is how hard they fought, how long they fought, what it took to pull people to sort of seeing and being willing to act on kind of beginning to undo some of this sort of systematic sort of segregation and racial inequality. And again, we have a lot more to go.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Gene Theo Harris from Brooklyn College at the City University of New York, looking back on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and a lot of the myth versus reality of his part in the civil rights movement. Back to your calls now. Carlene is with us in Brooklyn, the Wisconsin Brooklyn. Carlene, hi.
Mm-hmm. Hi. Thank you so much for your comments, Professor Harris. I just wanted to put a plug in for a class that is being taught, I believe, this year for the fifth time at the Fountain of Life Church in Madison. It's coordinated by Dr. Reverend G, who's pastor of that church. You might remember him from years back writing the Justified Anger article that appeared in the Isthmus here in Madison when he was pulled over in the parking lot of his church by police as a black man there, seeming questionable. Anyway, the class is Black History for a New Day. It starts next Monday, the 27th of January, from 7 to 9, and it features professors from the UW and panelists in over the 10 weeks to talk about exactly some of the things that you are talking about with a focus on Wisconsin, but beginning with how slavery didn't just benefit the South, benefited the whole economy of the colonies and bringing us right up to 2020. So I'd highly recommend it.
Hey, Carlene, I'm going to jump in. I want to get Gene in on this. This is one example here in Wisconsin. Do you see a movement, Gene, toward people trying to kind of return and come to grips with the realities of the civil rights movement?
Yeah, I certainly do. And I think people are very hungry. I mean, I think we are in the moment. We are in a moment of like hunger about, you know, thinking about, you know, thinking seriously about how we build movements today and therefore thinking seriously about the history, really wanting to learn the history of these movements. One book I can recommend for people interested in the civil rights movement in Milwaukee is Patrick Jones' Selma of the North. Just to sort of, I mean, I think partly we have to know this history. And I think regrettably, even as a sort of material on the Southern civil rights movement makes it into, you know, elementary school, high school, college, not always as much on the civil rights movement outside the South, but there are now a number of resources to draw on in terms of if you want to learn more on that as well.
Thanks for the call, Carlene. We'll go now to Lori with us in Vernon County. Lori, hello.
Oh, hello. Thank you. I'm interested in the letter in the Birmingham jail. That was also written to the black pastors in Birmingham as well, too. And I wonder if your professor would speak about the professional classes among the African Americans and how they interacted with Dr. King's movement. I'm also very interested in Chicago in the late 60s. It was interesting to me during the last election how John Lewis was not able to recall Bernie Sanders on the bridge, but Bernie Sanders had been being arrested in Chicago, facing down the Chicago police in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm. Lori, thanks for the call. Just a couple minutes left, Gene, for you to take that where you want to go.
Right. I think 2 points, right? I mean, I think partly why at first we couldn't recognize where Bernie Sanders was exactly this point, which is if we imagine and talk about the Southern civil rights movement as the civil rights movement, right, then it misses sort of all the things that people are doing in places outside of the South, including what's happening in Chicago, including what Bernie Sanders did. So I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing, in terms of the letter from a Birmingham jail, and he's writing as well to white clergy who had criticized him, is he is calling out right the white moderate in that letter, and saying that in some ways the white moderate is more dangerous to the struggle for freedom than the Ku Klux Klaner. In part, he's saying because people are more devoted to order than to justice. And in that letter, he also talks about the myth of time and this idea that Americans in particular sort of hold to, which is that things are getting better and it might be slow, but we're just constantly getting better. And Dr. King says, no, time is neutral, right? You have to use time in a positive way. Things aren't just going to get better, you know, ever slowly and surely, right? So, I mean, I think going back to the letter, really listening to what Dr. King says, I think gives us a lot for kind of where we are today.
Thanks for that call, Lori. In our last few moments, Jean, your point is toward more resources, more things we can check out to revisit the history of the civil rights movement across the country.
We are now very lucky in that there are all sorts of books about the civil rights movement outside the South. So you can look for Matthew Countryman's book on Philadelphia. You can look for Brian Purnell's book on Brooklyn. You can look for Nishani Fraser's book on Cleveland. You can look for, I've edited a number of collections of kind of new work on the Black freedom struggle. The most recent one is called The Strange Careers of the Jim Crow North. It has a whole bunch of essays from sort of new scholars looking at the Black freedom struggle outside the South. Tom Segrew has a book that kind of synthesizes sort of the Northern struggle. Kamosi Woodard works on Newark. Right now we are beginning to have kind of a really robust sort of literature on the civil rights movement outside the South. And so I think it's incumbent on us as citizens, as teachers, right? Those of us who are teachers or professors, right? That now that material sort of we can bring into our classes, we can bring into our discussions, but for many of us, we're going to have to sort of learn new stuff.
Jean, that's a good place to leave it. Thanks so much for joining us today. That was Jean Theo Harris, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Brooklyn College of the City, University of New York. Her books include A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Harry Houdini moved from Appleton to New York on his way to becoming the world's most famous magician. We'll talk to a Wisconsin magician who's taken the same path and now directs New York's Houdini Museum. First, Governor Tony Evers is out with a new plan to take on youth vaping here in Wisconsin. The move steps up enforcement of regulations already on the books, and it calls for some new legislative fixes, like a ban on vaping and e-cigarettes on school campuses. Lauren Weber is the Midwest correspondent for Kaiser Health News based out of St. Louis. She's joining us today from Washington, D.C. Lauren, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get into specifics of the Wisconsin plan, is this something we're seeing from state to state and at the federal level trying to figure out what we're doing about e-cigarettes?
You know, this is something we're seeing at the federal level. They've actually banned, obviously, all nicotine and vaping products for those under 21. And they've banned flavored products unless they are open case type of distribution. But, you know, state by state, there's been a lot of legislative action, like the governor is suggesting, to curb youth vaping. Because there's kind of two crises at hand here. You've got an absolute explosion of folks that are under the age of 21 using these vaping products. And you've also got, obviously, the vaping illnesses that are called EVALI by the CDC that have sickened and killed many people across the U.S. in kind of a separate crisis. And so both of those have combined to a lot of legislative momentum around for different governors in different states around hoping to stop both with one kind of stone, so to speak.
And part of Evers' plan is to bolster existing enforcement, and he wants to expand enforcement capabilities for state agencies. And as I understand it, you know, this federal ban on under 21 smoking and vaping, that's all well and good, but the federal, you know, the FBI is not going to come and enforce these vaping and cigarette laws. It's going to come down to the states, right?
It is going to come down to the states. And I guess my question is, you know, while, look, no one wants the youth to be vaping in any way, shape, or form, you don't want kids addicted to nicotine. And I think it's great to be working on getting these products out of the hands of kids. I'm not sure that they aren't already trying to do that. You talk to most middle school kids, middle school kid principals, they all have these boxes called vaping boxes, which is all the, you know, illicit materials they've confiscated over the years. And just because now it's illegal, you know, until you're 21 doesn't mean that they're not still going to be able to get their hands on it. So I am curious to see what he's looking to do. And I applaud movement to make more of an effort on it. But I also, I'm not sure how much of a dent it's going to make. I think a public relations campaign, which I believe is part of his plan, and some messaging that really gets at kids and teens to say, you know, look, this is not cool. Here are the potential side effects. Here's why this is a problem, is hopefully also a good route. Because, I mean, look, you know, alcohol has been banned for kids under the age of 21 for quite some time, and it's not like that's made a huge difference either. So, we'll see.
Has the vaping industry pushed back against rules that are targeting youth vaping, either in states or at the federal level?
The vaping industry's hands are somewhat tied on that because they have said publicly that they would like to curtail youth vaping. And, you know, if you'll remember back in the fall, Juul got rid of its flavors voluntarily, actually, before they were banned. So the vaping industry cannot come out and say that they want kids to be vaping because they're currently also embroiled in a lot of lawsuits saying that they did not specifically advertise to kids. So they cannot publicly say that. Will this take away some of their client base if this is successful? Yes, but theoretically they cannot actively advertise to kids under 21, nor have they in their minds been doing so. There's a lot of litigation around that right now.
Talking to Lauren Weber, Midwest correspondent for Kaiser Health News based in St. Louis. We're looking at new rules on vaping proposed by Governor Evers, probably be a part of his State of the State address later this week. He's looking to cooperate with the legislature on that. Also, what's going on at the federal level with kind of a changing target on banning certain e-cigarette flavors. Now, what have we seen? It seems like from the Trump administration, there's been a little bit of a shifting type of talk on what they were going to do up to this partial e-cigarette or flavored e-cigarette ban. Can you talk about the evolution of that?
Absolutely. And Wisconsin is somewhat of a battleground state for it as well, as you have a senator who is pro-vaping in Ron Johnson. So here, at the end of the day, here's what happened. Donald Trump thought or was told by some of his advisors that it'd be great to ban vaping because here's the deal. You know, a bunch of kids are vaping. Theoretically, the suburban moms would love it if he bans it. What became apparent, and I've done some reporting on, is that there is a massive constituent of people that feel very strongly about having the right to vape. A lot of them are non-smokers. They feel like it saved their lives. They think it's a smoking cessation tool. They really feel strongly about it. There's also a huge industry around vape shops. And so the president this past Friday was reported by both the New York Times and Axios, got rather irritated on a phone call and may have used some expletives with his Health and Human Services Secretary, Azar, about just wading into the vaping issue at all. Because what ended up happening is he somewhat walked back what he originally said he would do. And I don't necessarily think, according to the reporting, that he has an issue with what his eventual ban and raising the age to 21 ended up all being. I think he just has an issue with being associated with it at all. Because essentially, no one's really happy. Because the public health folks wish that he had banned vaping altogether, all flavors, you know, menthol still in there. And the open containers are also still in there. And the folks that are pro-vaping are mad that he banned anything at all. So I think he regrets wading into it as he feels like, according to the reporting, that it's been a bit of a hot-button issue.
Now, also at the federal level, we saw some changes from the CDC on its warnings about vaping. And this was partly linked to the dangerous, what turned out to be illicit bootleg, often THC products. What did we see change from the CDC?
So what the CDC did on Friday is they had a mass warning, just no one should vape, period, you know, full stop, as these Ebola cases, which are the vaping-related lung illness cases, kept popping up. What they've altered that now to say is that, you know, kids, pregnant women, and those that are sick should not vape. And no one should be vaping THC cartridges that they don't know where they came from. Why that is that they've discovered that out of the vaping illnesses, about, somewhat over 85, 86% of them are linked to adulterated THC cartridges, which are basically, it's when you're vaping a type of marijuana, but you're buying it on the black market, and it's been cut with something called vitamin E acetate, which is an oil. And that's what causes, at least they think, that's the running theory for now, a lot of these lung injuries. And so they altered their recommendation because they no longer, at least what that implies, is that they no longer see this as a vaping as a whole issue. Although they don't think kids should be vaping, they see it as, and people that don't use nicotine should be vaping, but they see it as a vaping, what's causing these vaping illnesses is the THC adulterated cartridges. So it's adjusting to account for that. Because I think what we've seen is, like I said at the beginning, you have two separate crises that have been very much conflated over the last couple of months. And I think they're trying to separate them out a little bit more than they necessarily did at the beginning.
Right. That seems like it is complicating the issue, the two separate issues, as you mentioned, kids vaping anything we don't want, and
right.
The disease, the lung illness that appears to be caused by these bootleg vaping products as a separate issue, and they really rolled together there for a while.
Absolutely. And that's what's aggravated a lot of people on both sides. I mean, they've been very frustrated that they've kind of been conflated. Look, at the end of the day, nobody wants their kid vaping. You don't want to be addicted to nicotine. It's not something you want your kid doing. And so it makes sense that when there was a vaping crisis where they didn't know what was causing these lung injuries, that they would come out and say no one should be vaping because they didn't know what was causing it. And I think what this is now is an adjustment for the fact that they really do have data that shows it's related to THC and that they feel comfortable now kind of separating that a bit more.
And Lauren, in our last minute or so, what are you watching for next in these in the story of e-cigarettes and vaping regulation?
I think it's really going to be interesting to see how this plays out in all the states. I mean, it seems that there's a lot of momentum behind, you know, getting kids off of vaping. But there are, like I said, there's a lot of momentum on the other side. I mean, if you log onto Twitter and Google hashtag We Vape, We Vote, you see a lot of people really riled up about the issue. You've seen crowds both at the White House and different state legislative steps protesting. I think we're going to see some finding about this in the years to come.
Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That's Lauren Weber, Midwest correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She was with us today to talk about a new plan from Governor Evers to combat youth vaping here in Wisconsin and the latest on national efforts to ban certain flavored e-cigarettes and the ongoing efforts to keep kids from vaping and to get a handle on a lung illness caused largely, it looks like, by illicit bootleg e-cigarette products. Coming up, we'll talk to the Wisconsinite who's now the director of the Harry Houdini Museum in New York City. He'll share the story of Wisconsin's famous magician and his own efforts to bring more people into the world of magic. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a special summer camp for the children of women incarcerated at Wisconsin's Tichita Prison. First, one of the most famous people to come out of Wisconsin is Harry Houdini. He was born in Hungary, and he spent part of his childhood in Appleton before eventually landing in New York and becoming the world's top illusionist. Fast forward to today, and another Wisconsin magician is following that path and trying to make the magic profession more inclusive in the process. Rajon Lynch, also known as RJ the Magician, was born in Racine and graduated from UW Oshkosh. He now directs the Houdini Museum of New York. He'll be back in Oshkosh to perform this Friday. He recently talked to Central Time producer Dean Canetter.
So how did you first become interested in magic and figure out that it was something you might want to do for a living?
Well, I wasn't really good at magic my whole life, ironically. I started off when I was about 9, and there was a Disney show that people don't seem to remember but me. It was called Now You See Me. And it was before Now You See It, and they used to show magic during the commercial breaks. And I used to learn just a little bit of magic during the commercials. But like I said, I was horrible at magic because I had no idea like how to perform until I was about 19. And I got hired to work at a performing arts camp because I saw a poster at my school for this camp. Don't know how it got there. No one's worked there ever before. No one's worked there since. And I got hired. Actually, one person has worked there since. I actually was able to bring a friend. But I got hired to work at this camp, and I was super nervous. You know, I practiced all summer, or right before the summer, I practiced the whole time and trying to learn these tricks from YouTube. And so I'd have something to teach the kids. And I realized when I got there that I wasn't good enough. Like, all the kids knew the YouTube tricks. And I was just so bad at magic that I was like, I'm going to come back next year, and I'm going to kill it. I'm going to learn as much as I can, read the books. I'm going to practice. So when I first started doing magic, no one wanted to hire me because I didn't know anything and I wasn't good. So I started to do magic around my school. We had a homeless shelter, and I did magic at the homeless shelter for these kids, and because they would let me come in and do it for free. And that kind of helped me build a little bit of clout. So then when I started to go to like the YMCA, I'm like, yeah, I do magic at the homeless shelter. And it's like, oh, that's so great. And then they let me do my first show. It was making like $200 at the YMCA doing balloon animals and magic. That's kind of how I got my start doing magic.
And your path, at least geographically, has been similar to Harry Houdini so far. He also spent time in Appleton and later moved to New York City. When you were getting into magic, was he someone who was on your radar, someone who might have been an inspiration?
You know, I read his biography when I was in elementary school, and I didn't realize that he was from Wisconsin. I kind of forgot about it, and then I started to get hired in Oshkosh. And when I got hired there, I started getting hired in Appleton, and I got a lot more gigs in Appleton, and people kept asking me if I was like the new Houdini, and I didn't know what they meant. And then I realized that Houdini was from Appleton, and that's why they have Houdini Plaza, that's why I have the Houdini Museum. And then I started to kind of like ride that a little bit, because I was kind of the new young face of magic for the area, and I think they were really waiting for something like, you know, when you go to the Houdini's restaurant, they always ask, is there a magician? And they say no. You know, I think they're kind of waiting for a little bit of magic in Appleton, which is nice.
And how did you come then to your current job, which is directing the Houdini Museum in New York?
Well, this last summer, one of the kids I used to teach in New York knows the owner of the Houdini Museum, who's like the curator. And he recommended me for the job because he knows I'm really good with press. So like if you like Google me, you'll see like a lot of like press articles about me and Houdini and the history of magic that I've written. And these are like things that I learned, like I really liked writing, and that's why I switched my major from marketing to communication, because I realized I had a talent for it once I started it. So that was kind of the reason that they contacted me. And then I came in for an interview maybe a week after moving to New York. I just wanted like a normal job. You know, I just wanted to work in New York for a year after gigging for 4 years really hard. I didn't really want to do something magic related because I felt it might pigeonhole me. But it's really hard to get a job in New York, and they offered me this job. And I'm like, you know, maybe I can turn this into a PR job. So that's kind of what I do, a lot of writing, and I try to approach it in a little bit of a different way, being the museum director. And then they hired me.
Gotcha. And for visitors that come there, what's the collection like? I hear there's a lot of great Houdini paraphernalia.
Yeah, we have a lot of really great Houdini things. We have his metamorphosis trunk, which is like the original, it's fastest quick change in the world. That's what we call it. It's like worth $300,000. We have over $3 million worth of Houdini things here. We also have a lot of chain from the original movie, which they're actually loaned out to Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh for the Houdini movie. We just have like a lot of really cool original Houdini things. And you can even come and buy like one of Houdini's keys. And we sell like one of his original like keys for picking locks that for like $1,500. We actually sell like a decent amount of them. So we have a lot of really cool Houdini merchandise here.
We're talking with Rajon Lynch right now, also known as RJ the Magician, a Wisconsin native who now directs the Houdini Museum in New York. And Rajon, you've alluded to this a little bit so far, bringing young people face-to-face with magic, if they might not have otherwise had a chance to get a taste of it. I hear that's something you're doing at the museum. Can you talk about how you're making that happen?
Yeah, well, I love to make connections with people, first of all. So, like, when I was in Wisconsin, I used to, like, call just random people, and I see them, like on the internet or something like that. And I'm like, you know what, we should work together or do something. So I have a few friends I was able to bring to, like, magic camp with me. One of them is my friend Caleb Hyatt, who we're doing the show with that we'll talk about later. But in the Houdini Museum, we try to get in, like, lots of tour groups and stuff like that, different kind of kids from all different areas, so that we're able to, you know, show them that magic isn't just something that like weird people do. A lot of people think that's the stigma. It's not just something that that you do if you're like really good at magic. You can learn magic from the start, and you can build your own like career doing it. And it's one of the very few art forms where people will pay you from the start a really decent amount of money. You know, not like acting where you have to like you know, book a show first, or like music, you gotta have to build a band. You know, as a magician, you can go out, advertise yourself, and you can make a lot of money per hour by just bringing a deck of cards and some like rope and whatever you use for magic.
And even if someone might not make a career out of magic, is it still worthwhile to give it a shot?
Yeah, magic, well, at least for me, magic has, like, I had stage fright. I had horrible stage fright. Magic gave me a medium to express myself. And I do comedy magic. So I used to do kids magic when I first started, but now I do comedy clubs. I get hired for a lot of things like corporate events and things like that. And it helps you with your confidence. It helps you with the public speaking. Since I've been doing magic, I've been able to lecture at, like, Carthage College, UW Oshkosh, I think a college in Green Bay. I was able to give a TED Talk. And all things that I never thought I could do on stage, I can now do, whether they're magic-related or not magic-related.
And I understand that you're also doing work to bring more people of color and women into the magic world. What do you think are the keys to expanding opportunity to everyone who might want to try this out for a living?
Well, a big key of it is that whenever I do anything, I definitely send it out to the news because I want people to see that people who look like me are doing something a little bit different. So that's why recently I was able to get in the New York Times, AM New York, which is the third biggest paper in New York, Fox, NBC. And I think that's really important to show people that, like, hey, this dude is like a normal looking young black guy. You wouldn't expect him to like do some magic or like be really good at magic or to be the director of a museum, but that's what he's doing. And then for women, we always encourage girls that come in to do some magic or like learn a trick or something like that, because honestly, there's not a lot of female magicians. So like, honestly, it's up for grabs. You can't name a famous female magician. So it's something that is it's really cool, like opportunity that's out there.
Now, you are coming back to Wisconsin for a performance on January 24th in Oshkosh. Give us a little preview. What can people expect from the show?
Well, this is really cool because, like I said, my friend Caleb is from Oak Creek. And when I first got hired at the summer camp in New York, they asked me if I knew anyone else that might want to come. And I just called this guy that I knew from a connection who wasn't, like, super great at magic yet. But we became really good friends. We practiced a lot, and we worked together in New York. So he's very, very good now, and he's the official magician of the Indy 500. So he goes down there every summer. Yeah, he goes down there every summer for the Indian NASCAR and does magic for the business suites and just kills it. And then we have another guy, again, like I like to call people. I saw this guy named Noah Sony from Minnesota, who's another 20, we're the same age, a black magician, and he runs a show called The Magic Underground in Minnesota. So I just gave him a call. I'm like, we should work together sometime. Like, it was like 2 years ago. And now I finally have like the means to be able to like, be like, hey, come, I'll pay you, come travel, and we'll do a show together. So all three of us, we're all under the age of 24, we're all doing a show, we're all very experienced, and it's going to be a really fun kind of like comedy magic night, and it's going to be it's relatively kid-friendly. I'll say 12 and up. So that's what we're doing in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, January 24th at the Time Theater. It's really cool vaudeville movie theater, like old movie theater.
And Rajan, as we wrap up, I've got to ask you one thing about doing magic. Whenever I see a magic trick firsthand, there's a point where I realize something out of the ordinary has happened, and then I can't help but smile, shake my head, maybe scream, depending on the trick. But there's a moment of joy there. And I'm wondering, from where you stand as the magician, what is that moment like?
Well, I don't know if this is rare or common, but for me, I just do magic because I enjoy it. You know, like people like it a lot, but like it makes me happy. So that's why I do it. So it's like from my perspective, I sometimes get a little bit like, not frustrated, that's not the word, but I get a little bit anxious because I'm like, people can't enjoy this. Like, they know that I'm telling them I'm going to trick them, and for some reason they still like seem surprised. But it's something kind of have to get over, and it's a really fun thing to do, to be able to make people have this like moment where they're not expecting it, especially as magicians will say, it's for adults, because we think we've seen everything, and then we get to see something that we can't explain.
Well, Rajan, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate the time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Rajan Lynch, also known as RJ the Magician, is a Wisconsin native who now directs the Houdini Museum of New York. He talked to Central Time producer Dean Kinetter. He's performing at the Time Community Theater in Oshkosh on Friday at 7:30. Rajan is, I should say, not Dean. Though I'd pay to see that, too. There are tickets available to RJ the Magician show at Oshkosh via eventbrite.com. By the way, coming up later this week, join us Wednesday evening at 7 for live coverage of Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers' State of the State Address. That will be hosted by Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson and PBS Wisconsin's Frederica Freiberg. Governor Evers will highlight priorities for 2020 before a joint session of the Wisconsin State Legislature in the state Capitol building. Wisconsin State Senator Roger Roth will provide this year's Republican response following that address. Again, get live coverage of the State of the State address. That's coming up this Wednesday evening at 7. You can listen to that on the Ideas Network or stream it live at WPR.org. Have you ever asked yourself, if I was a bird, which bird would I be? The answer, on the off chance that you have thought that, is out there. The Cornell Ornithology Lab, these are some serious bird people, they're hosting a personality quiz on their website, What Bird Are You? You just answer some questions about yourself, then find out which bird you have a kinship with. Yeah, it's like a lot of those online quizzes on social media, but these people really know their birds. You can find the Cornell Lab quiz by searching for What Bird Are You Most Like? In the interest of hard-hitting journalism, I took the quiz myself, and I got red-tail hawk, and I am totally cool with that. I like the red-tail hawk a lot. Here's some of their description of the red-tail hawk and what it means about me. They say, you're smart and curious, strong and determined, okay. Your voice is so magnificent that you can make a living in Hollywood. I like these bird people. They're great. You understand strategy and sometimes work with a partner, but overall, most of the time, you're happy to be alone. Yeah, that's me. And by the way, a fun fact, the cry of the red-tail hawk is often used on TV shows in scenes showing a bald eagle. The red-tailed hawk sounds more like what we think a raptor is going to sound like, apparently, than the bald eagle. That's true. And one time a red-tailed hawk, just while I was at a red light, came down and landed on my windshield wiper, kind of stared at me for, 5-10 seconds, the light changed, and it flew away. So, yeah, I guess this does make a lot of sense. Bird news you can use. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.